It's my great pleasure to welcome, for the first time, to the stage side of our little space here, our good friend Chance Massaro. Chance has had a wide-ranging career in education on many levels. He created the Brain. Remind me of
Successful Brain Fair.
Successful Brain Fair. Thank you. That's what I know him for. But he's also been a participant in our community here, and so we are delighted to have and welcome Chance Massaro. So join me in welcoming Chance.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you for coming.
And thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. And I do very much invite you to make as much trouble as you possibly can during our brief time. Another word about me is that I spent 30 plus years as an organization development consultant and trainer. And I worked throughout the state of California helping people with planning and communication. So I've just been fascinated with the idea of learning and also the excitement of realizing that every single person learns in a different way. And so the best kind of learning is not teaching, but where an individual is curious about how they learn. And in a community, we can help one another to learn by joining them in being their own brain scientist. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming. Ask a question at any time. Let me just ask quickly, I assume you're here about the topic. Would that be a fair assumption? So would you let me know what are you thinking about in relation to why you came here tonight?
Longevity.
Longevity.
Staying alive in a quality mode.
Okay. So being your own brain scientist may indeed maintain or even improve the quality of your longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anybody else?
You put the words learning and community together.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, I realize that, you know, my father was a sociology teacher, and though he never talked to me, I got something about the power of community, the power of culture. There's so many examples where culture prohibits one from being their own brain scientist. Hi. Thank goodness.
Am I sitting here?
No, you're sitting there. Thanks for coming. I'm just asking people why they're here. And you're here for quality of life, and I'm very excited about that. And Michael is talking about community and learning, putting those two together. And I'm very excited about this, and the example that I want to stress is family. Because in a family, you have an opportunity to see someone, to see yourself very intimately, and you can see how a person responds to the world, how they go for what they want, how they complete what they want, how they overcome obstacles. And with a very simple way of acting called appreciative inquiry, when you notice someone doing something that works for them, right? It can be very, very interesting to reflect that back to them. So if you imagine doing this with children, a child does something, sets out on a project of some sort, right? And you notice what they do before they get into it, how they're feeling or what they're talking about or how they're acting or something. And they may not know, they may not be attending to how they're feeling or what they're thinking, but you can reflect that back. You know, you were You were excited. You were jumpy. You were hungry. And just let yourself be that mirror that helps a person see themselves more accurately, or at all. So the process that I'd like to share with you is really pretty pedestrian. It's actually something we do all the time anyway. But I've put it together into a kind of form. So to begin, I'd like to ask you this question. What does a scientist do? What do you think? What was your understanding of what a scientist do?
Observe and see whether it matches a hypothesis.
Okay. So they observe, and oftentimes they say, I wonder what that's about. Right? How did that happen? And then they make a hypothesis, make a guess about it. And then they set about to find out if that's true. Right? Does that make sense to people? So, in my estimation, little tiny children are the best scientists. They know exactly how to watch their parents, see what works, see what doesn't work, and manipulate the whole system. They are fantastic at that. So as they, what they do is they notice what works, and they try again, and they try again, and they try it again. And pretty soon you have a monster on your hands. And I speak from experience, because I have a 3-year-old granddaughter, and she's got her parents right around her finger. You can see how it works. So what I'd like to share with you is this idea of looking at ourselves in a particular kind of way, particularly attending to what works. Because what you notice in a lot of culture is that we pay a whole lot of attention to what doesn't work. Right? Oh darn, I did that again. Oh, that was a problem. And not only that, but we review what doesn't work. And we predict what doesn't work. And this is so pervasive that it's shocking when you really realize it. I was at a birthday party on Saturday, and is it wise to respond to your hand signals or just observe them?
Oh, you can respond. It means something. You said stir something.
You're stirred?
Something stirred something.
Okay, good.
And if you want to take that risk, then you can invite me.
Okay, do you want to say something?
Yeah, about what you just said.
Okay, go ahead.
I was reminding me of one of my favorite poems by Piet Hein. He wrote these funny little poems called Crooks.
Crooks?
Crooks.
Okay.
And one of them was, the road to wisdom, well, it's plain and simple to express, to err and err and err again, with less and less and less.
To err and err and err again, but less and less and less. So, when you have a situation where you're going to do something, and you do that something, and it works or it doesn't work, or parts of it work and parts of it don't work, right? Unfortunately, what I've noticed in my interest in education is a lot of people pay a lot of attention to the part that doesn't work, as opposed to saying, this is what I learned from that. This is what I learned. And it just really changes the whole thing. Our cerebral cortex can grab onto something and review it and review it and review it to death. And we end up being, in many ways, our own worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And if we change that orientation to appreciative inquiry, in other words, I'm constantly looking for anything I do right. Moreover, I'm saying to myself, why did that work? Why did that work in terms of me and my thinking and my neurotransmitters and my environment? Why did that work? Now, again, if you have any experience with little kids, you know that they're just automatic with that. It's not cerebral for them at all. They just naturally go toward doing what worked again, right? So this, like I say, what I'm going to share with you is something that people do a lot. My main interest is in lessening the focus on the negative, lessening the perseverance of what we think about that didn't work, and increasing the interest and the observation of what does work, and also asking why did that work? What was it about that that worked? So, given that, is there something that you're interested in as we begin? Do you have a question? Do you have a request? Is there something that you would like to investigate?
I have a question about what you just said, and that is focusing on what works and not what doesn't work. But there is something missing in that in my head, and that is that if there isn't something that worked, and you have sort of a lesson to learn from.
Yes.
I mean, then that, I guess, is the positive, looking at the situation in a positive light.
Exactly.
But there's some review. There's a review process of like, gee, that was, so what were my steps and what happened as a whole? But then there's so many other factors that it sort of complicates it. It depends upon what it is, you know. Yeah. So.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I am by no means saying that we should not honor and participate in our feelings. But like most of my work these days is with elders. And it's really appalling to me how much elders often carry around this greasy sack of their errors and their problems from years and years ago. An example was this one woman, her first child was like 3 or 4 or something, and wanted to come in, had a nightmare and wanted to come in bed with her and her husband, you know, 35 years ago. And the husband said, no. And so she put the kid back in bed, and he cried and screamed and was unhappy. She beat herself up for years and years and years about that. I said, how did the kid turn out? She said, oh, he's fine. But she carried this around. So that, she didn't learn anything. She did learn something from it. But the emphasis was on, oh, I did a bad thing, as opposed to, I learned to tell my husband to shut up and let the kid in the bed. Right? So the next kid that came along went in bed, and she said yes. The husband said no. She said, be quiet. And she brought the other kid in bed because she learned something. So you can always turn it into, but then the focus, the perseveration wants to be about, what did I learn? What did I learn? Is that making sense? So I'm honoring very much what you're saying. And you're right, there's all kinds of circumstances and things going on. Okay, is there a question?
So, are you saying not to look at what doesn't work, or just to get a better balance between both what didn't work and what did work?
See, this is the question. I am saying look at what didn't work and go into it and talk about it and think about it. Oftentimes it involves the internal parts of the brain, most specifically the amygdala, that really hangs on to something that doesn't work, which is it's an evolutionary trait, right? If you know, there's snakes over there, don't go over there, or you know, these berries are poison, whatever you have. So yes, we have to pay attention to it, but we don't perseverate. It's really interesting. I mean, you see somebody breaks their arm, right? And they show up in a few days later, and everybody wants to know what happened to your arm, right? And so they will repeat the story over and over and over again, not realizing that when they tell the story, the same chemicals that were generated in their body when they had the accident are now being generated again and again and again and again. And there's nothing that creates a better neural pathway than repetition. Right? So I, for example, recommend that my participants, if they fall down, they have a bruise on their face, they tell people they were wrestling alligators, you know, or whatever. But don't review it. Yes?
You just answered my question.
Yeah.
How?
You mind reading people.
I mind reading people. Okay,
great. Answer the question.
So, the example I'd like to share with you is the example that I use all the time with my participants. And just a brief side note that my work with elders has really changed a tremendous amount since I've increasingly studied neurotransmitters and hormones and what an individual can do in relation to their own production of these chemicals. So, what I want to share with you tonight, what I want to focus on the concept of remembering. When I wrote my book, Easy Genius, I went around to a lot of different places and said, I have this simple book that's organized around... what's it called? Information mapping. So that this structure of the page is the same on most of the pages, so that you know that this part of the page is about abstraction, this part of the page is about relationships, and this part of the page is practical, go do it kind of stuff. A little bit based on neuro-linguistic programming, eye movement sorts of studies. And the only people who were really interested in the book and my seminars were elders, people who were afraid they were losing their memory. And you find that people who are losing their memory, here we are with community, the person says, oh, I forgot my keys. I'm always forgetting my keys. Somebody else says, yeah, I forget my keys all the time too. Right? And as people age, then they're around older people, and the thing gets reified over and over and over. You cross this bridge to 80 years old, you're going to lose your brains, right? And the adult children help their parents. Mom, I told you that 10 minutes ago, right? Something's wrong with you, and so that this reification repetition process goes on and on, and some of the most enjoyable workshops that I do are with families, so I can tell the adult children, knock it off, notice what you do right, you know, and say, hey mom, you turned off that light, very well done, thank you. So this is just an example tonight. So let me hear from you. If you wanted to improve your memory about something, what would you want to improve your memory about? Yes?
I'm interested in anomic aphasia, where it's word recall. It's, you know, the other day somebody was saying, what do you call that thing that you hang your clothes on the line with? They couldn't remember the word clothes being.
Right.
And I'm discovering, I think it's rampant in society stage, and it's younger people as well.
Right.
But I'm wondering if there's something about nutrition, some toxins or something.
Well, one of the interesting things that I notice is, yes, that happens to everybody, and in a, what do we call it, multitasking world, distraction is the name of the game.
Uh-huh.
So you're talking about something, and maybe something catches your eye, and you don't pay attention to it, but you drop that word out. Right? So there's a lot of different reasons, internally and externally, why you would drop that word out. What's that word? You know? And then the physiological stuff that happens is very interesting. We all of a sudden are breathing more shallowly. And there's an embarrassment. So the embarrassment is a surging of choline in the bloodstream. And you're all of a sudden in a stress mode where you're not going to think very clearly when you immediately put yourself, and it happens like that, right? I can't think of this word. Ooh! Right? And all the body tenses up. And the reason I give you gum is that gum is relaxing. Gum is really relaxing. There are other benefits of gum as well. But a longitudinal study in Japan a few years ago showed that habitual gum chewers have many fewer heart attacks because they're constantly telling their body, everything's okay, everything's okay, everything's okay. But when senior, when a word drops out for a senior, for an elder person, they'll say, ah, see, I'm getting older, and therefore, I can't think of these words. And it just spirals. Because the brain believes what you tell it. And if you start telling the brain, you're not doing it well, you're not doing it well, something's wrong, what's wrong with me? You hear this all the time. And that just spirals. It gets worse and worse. 20-year-olds often don't do that. You say, oh, I can't think of that word. And they, on they go. Right? But when you get older, you and the community begin to notice, ah, you are older and you did that thing that we've always done but paid no attention to.
So it's confirmation bias.
Bingo!
Confirmation what?
Bias.
Well, I also think you're onto something. They've done studies on this that they show that there is something affecting younger folks that are having less memory, that they're not sure what kind of things in the environment that might be. But it could also be what Chance is saying about.
There's a new condition called digital dementia.
Okay.
Somebody who's 24 years old, 14 hours on the computer daily, he has the brain of an 85-year-old.
Okay, I didn't Google know that.
Yeah. Check this one out, yes.
I used to, for a period of my life, I was taking care of dying people who were in the dying phase of their life. And I, one person had the experience of remembering that he used to be able to do a certain task, say, balance a checkbook. And he was a very meticulous person, anyway. And now he could not do it. He couldn't remember how to do it. You know, like, so I guess my question is, there's that experience that I've observed in some elder people where they remember that they used to remember how to do something,
right,
and now they can't remember. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When we're interested in memory, we really realize that there's an interesting kind of conundrum here. On the one hand, we don't know what it is. How is it that calcium and potassium and different kinds of neurotransmitters between these tiny little cells zapping one another, how is that that produces the taste of Pinot Noir that you had 25 years ago? How is it that that helps you remember a birthday party and the colors and the people who were there and the taste of the cake? How? It's a mystery, right? However, we do understand how to work it. And there's really only two influences. The brain works by connection. So if something comes in, I connect it. Right? And if it's nonsense, the brain doesn't want it. The brain doesn't like nonsense. So I make it mean something. All right, but the other piece of it is not just association, but repetition. And here again, we're back with the broken arm, or I fell, or whatever it is. But the more it's repeated, the more I'm going to get memory. The strongest association of them all is emotion. And the strongest, the structure in your brain, the amygdala, is really focused on the negative, wants you to remember the negative. But it doesn't want you to do that again. So you talk about it and you think about it, and you create goals like, I don't want to do that ever again. Right? So these are the two main influences. Now, what you've got is, here's a person who balances checkbooks for ages and ages and ages. He made strong neural pathways about how to do that and how to check it and be right with it. And then he stopped doing it. We don't know how long, but he stopped doing it. Well, those neural pathways begin to fade. Now, if he said, for example, I really want to remember how I do that. Show me again how to balance my checkbook. Let's do it. Let's try it. That stuff would start coming back to him like crazy. I remember my father was raised in an Italian family, didn't speak English until he went to school in Ohio. And by the time he was 30, all he could do was swear in Italian. But when he went back to visit his family, boom, it all came back because none of them spoke English. So it would slowly, you know, the first day he'd just have a couple of words, and then the second day he'd have a couple of sentences, and by the end of a two-week vacation, he'd be jabbering away with all of them. But here's the thing, again, you got to remember that your brain believes what you tell it. So if you say, I can't remember, I can't do a checkbook anymore, guess what the brain said? Yep, that's us. Can't do it. So when you're into that negative, I can't do it, your brain believes it and says, okay, fine. I lose my keys all the time? Okay, I'll see if I can lose my keys now. Right? That's the whole concept of believing who you are.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
All the time.
And what's precious about this whole thing is to me, this is the engine.
And that's where we all want to go. Because you want success in your life. You don't want failure. You want success. So you're constantly using tools. I had to learn this the hard way because my book is packed with tools. Right? But without a desire and without a goal, a tool is foolish. There's no value to the tool.
But when you want something, you say, I want to get this, I want to learn this, I want to remember this, I want to use this, then you're looking for tools, and tools fit right in and you use them.
And if you use them over and over and over, you get a strong neural pathway, and you can do it with your eyes closed, so to speak. And then when you stop doing them, that neural pathway fades. The brain is extremely economical. That little 2.5-pound blob of fat in your head is busy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the time. In fact, it's said by some that it's busier when you're asleep than when you're awake. But at any rate, if you stop using the part of it, it says, why should I supply blood for that part? Right? Why should I keep everything up to snuff if you're not using it? So it fades. But it never, ever goes away. So if that older person said, I really want to know how to balance my checkbook, you say, oh great, let's get the bank statement, let's get your checkbook. We can do that. And two sessions, you would notice the guy saying, oh yeah, well you got to subtract this, and don't forget this cost. Right? He'd be right there. So jump in at any time.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Welcome. So this is the piece on memory is that we make thousands of connections. Now let's just take a look quickly at the handout, because the handout then is offering you, and the way this works is on the left side of page is a left brain way of stating these ideas. And on the right side of the page is a right brain way of expressing a similar kind of thing. So this is what I'm suggesting. Before you want to remember something, you do what you can to prepare to remember. How do you get ready? So let me just ask you again. Let's see if we could just play with this. And remember, I'm using memory only as an example, because this can work in many, many different environments. So if I want to prepare to anything, but in this case, remember, what do you suggest that I do?
Pay attention.
Hold on. This is preparation. This is before. So, for example, if I asked you how you get dressed,
say, oh, I pick out a shirt, right? I pay attention to all that. That's in the now of the instance that you're trying to remember. I'm talking about before that. Yes.
Let go of everything. Instead of state, memory is it's kind of it's like a mirror. I think it's a mirror beyond this tree. And it's first enjoy that it's there. Be appreciative and know that this remarkable function is ready to work.
Wow, wait, hold on. Okay, so I'm letting go of something, right?
Yeah.
But I'm
making
also
space,
there's also
space for it to arrive.
Can you give us another sentence on make space? How do I make space for something to arrive?
It's kind of like a landing pad.
I like it. It's kind of like landing pad, but how do I actually do it? What goes on in my head?
Have an open, loving heart.
Trust.
Okay.
Where are we? It's a basketball.
Loving heart. Anything else? What occurs to you as possible? Yes.
Remind myself that I want to remember.
Okay.
Say it out loud.
Take a nap.
Maybe even I want to remember this because,
I jot down a note on anything else so that I can clear my mind in space.
Okay, so I'm going to let go, I'm going to make space, I might note what I'm not going to think about.
Right.
Okay, I got that. That's trapped over there. I'm done with that. Right? Beautiful. What else? This is so interesting, because when you think about it, we prepare for everything in our lives. Every single thing we do, we prepare for, except to think. We don't do a lot of preparation to think. But now we're on to it. We make space for it. We realize that we want to do it. We get some rest. Right? What else?
Stop with the intoxicants, the sugar, alcohol. I mean, you could go to diet.
So okay.
You order brain healthy foods and not eat a lot of carbs.
Great. What else?
Get your blood flowing. Exercise.
Well, and all of those things will keep you de-stressed.
Okay. So one of the things we want to let go of is stress. We want to guide our chemicals away from choline and adrenaline and more into things like endorphins and serotonin and dopamine.
It seems to me if you're trying to remember, often it's hard to remember, but if you're relaxed, if your mind is relaxed, then you're more apt to remember.
And again, the gum.
The gum.
Which reinforces memory because there's taste and smell, and your jaw is moving right there by your temporal lobe.
Is there a special kind of memory gum?
Double your pleasure.
Double your memory.
Double your memory.
Help me out with this. What else am I going to do? What else could I do
have
to prepare
fun.
To remember? What?
Have fun.
Okay. I'm going, let me put it this way. I'm going to anticipate fun. Let me point out what Jim says here. It's really powerful. And it begins to show you why the Venn diagram on the right-hand side here. Because what you can see is what I do before may be motivating or motivated by what's going to happen after. So if I say because, then I'm putting myself into the future, probably. And using the frontal lobe to plan for what. Why am I going to learn this? The more reasons you have, the more motives you have, the more likely you're going to use whatever tools you have. Making sense? Anybody? Yes?
Sometimes when I want to remember something, I use my fingers, you know, like touch my first finger and say, this is that, this is, you know, this is the first thing, this is the second thing, this is the third thing.
I thought you were going to say the remembering mudra.
Oh, no. That's interesting. I actually hadn't thought of that. But I found that it helps me remember so that, you know, like, the next day I can go like this, and it'll help bring it back.
So this is the kind of thing that we don't necessarily think about this when we're talking to people. But, I mean, let me just ask. Have you told a lot of people that?
No.
Pardon me?
There's some remembering mudra?
No.
He just puts what he wants to remember on the different fingers, like, right? And then when he wants to remember it, he touches that finger, he says, oh yeah, it's the ice cream I remember.
Right. Like, for shopping. You know. And I forgot to write it down on the list, but I'm in the car, so I'll go like this.
Right.
Don't forget the...
Or remember.
Yes.
Let's put the negatives over there. So, what the beginning piece here is, do you know the common ways of looking at learning style? Are you a visual learner? Is that a strong influence on yours? So you'd want to take a picture of what you wanted, or visualize it in your head. Maybe that doesn't work for you. Are you an auditory learner, where you're going to make tapes in your head, where you're going to repeat what you hear? Are you a kinesthetic learner? Are you going to put it in your hand? Right? We used to tie a little knot around your finger.
Yeah.
Right? Remember that? So this is what this is about. The more you learn how you learn, the more you can use your own tools. Now, you can buy a memory book, and they're full of tools. But again, it's this piece here that to say, I want to remember, and why do I want to remember? Because. And then I begin to use my tools. And the tools that fit me, that work for me. And it's a tremendous combination of things. But a way for you to understand that belief is extremely important. I have a somewhat unusual name, and it's always interesting to notice how people react. Some people will say, that's a weird name, I'll never remember that. And they won't. And other people say, that's a very interesting name, I'll never forget that. And they won't. Right? So, having a sense that I can do it is really important. And it may be really, really complicated stuff, but if you're constantly telling yourself, this is challenging, this is interesting, this is weird, and I can do it, I will succeed. Right?
How about...
Your brain believes you. Yes?
How about, this is a very interesting name to try remembering.
Yeah, you can do that. Sure. And you got your tools, right?
Yoda, there is no try.
Somebody reminded me.
It implies failure. You don't say, I'm trying to ride a bike. You say, I'm going to ride a bike.
Yeah. So they say, I'm trying to pick up this cup. Sorry, can't do it. So belief is really important. If people walk into a situation, they think, this is over my head, I'll never get this, right? They will not get this. As I said, as I started to tell this story about this party I went to, and in the evening we had this wonderful meal, and then they brought out this quote-unquote cake. it was not a cake. It was a giant piece of fudge in the shape of a cake, you know? And they cut it like this, right? Chocolate. And this one man is saying, man, that looks good. I wish that you had brought that out in the morning. He says, I should not eat that chocolate because it'll keep me up all night long. So I said, okay, great. We got another cake over here, a carrot cake. You can just have some of that. Guess what? He ate some of that fudge thing. Hey, man, how'd you sleep? Not at all. He told his brain what was going to happen. I'm going to eat that stuff, and I'm going to be up all night. This is really valid stuff. When I lived on Wagdon Road, there was a family out there, and they said, well, it's winter time, we're all going to get the flu. Guess what? Every winter, they all got the flu. You know that expression, get in here, you'll catch your death of cold. Right? Oh, tell me what I'm supposed to do. Catch my death. So talking to yourself, I can, I will, it'll be fun, it'll be interesting, it'll be worthwhile. I'll share it with other people. All kinds of things that you tell yourself that are going to make the whole process profitable. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's reminding me of people I wish had come here.
It's one of the most common things I hear. Very, very common. So then, when that's before, right? And you can do that as you're walking to a lecture. You can say, Jeb, I'd like to ask this question. I wonder if they're going to talk about this. I wonder if they're going to do this. I wonder if they're going to do that. Just wondering. And for another interesting one is like you're coming to Many Rivers and you're going to see somebody talk. You can say, I wonder who's going to be there. Oh, I bet Michael will be there. Yeah, Jim, he's usually there. What are you doing? You're awakening the temporal lobe that stores a whole bunch of names. So when you meet somebody new, you know, you've already got stuff going up there. You've got some places to put those letters. Talking about it. Talking about what you want to get out of it. Thinking about that. So then during, that's the preparation. During, again, as I said, the whole idea is connection. Right? So you connect in a couple of main ways. One is through your senses, very, very strong. And the other is through what is sometimes called intelligence. And it is commonly thought that how you respond to your senses is pretty well hardwired. In other words, that you do this with your fingers arose in you naturally because of your relationship with your body. Somebody else might be more visual, auditory, or movement-oriented. There are a myriad different ways in which our senses show up. The nose is really powerful. Intelligence is, you know, when Piaget was talking about learning, he more or less saw there a couple of different ways. But along in the 50s comes this guy, Gardner, who says, no, there are seven. Seven different ways to make things mean. Because the brain doesn't like stuff that doesn't mean. Like if I started to speak to you in Urdu, you'd leave, right? He's not making sense. But if it makes sense, then you can take it in. And there are some things that we make sense of ourselves, and that's where a lot of misunderstanding comes. But in the book, I talk about 11 different ways that we make something meaningful. And they do relate to different parts and different functions of the brain. This is not strict, but we do know that different parts of the brain tend to be interested in different kinds of things. So there's logical intelligence, logical mathematical, musical, very common to most humans, musical intelligence, visual spatial, where things are and how things relate in the visual field, kinesthetic, as we've mentioned, right? This is really neat because you've seen a lot of books recently about emotional intelligence, right? What is emotional intelligence? Emotional intelligence is I know what's going on in me and I'm interested in what's going on in you. Those two.
Your neurons, limbic resonance.
Bingo! Right. So that I'm aware that as you gesture, I could gesture that way too. As you break open the coconut, well, I could do that too, right? Mirror neurons. So there are at least, but my theory is that there are as many intelligences as there are people, right? But the ones that we can pretty well identify are things like musical, natural, logical, spatial. Is that making sense to people?
Okay.
So while something is going on, while you're involved in something that you want to remember, you notice what's going on in your body. You notice what's going on around you. You notice how you feel, right? How comfortable you feel, or how engaged you feel, or you're thinking, oh, I can use this, oh, I can use it, I'll try that, right? So then the last chunk of this is what do you do afterwards? So before I'm thinking about it, I want it, I can get it, it will be fun, it will be fine. And because I have a motivation for doing it, I have a reason based in my values, okay? Then I'm in whatever situation it is that I want to remember things, and I'm aware of focus. I'm aware of making relationships. I'm aware of the sound of the voice, right? I'm just really in my body. I'm in the present, 100%. And again, I'm not thinking about other stuff, right? I created space to prepare, so great. Now I have all this space inside of me for this stuff to come and relate and connect and associate. So then the whole idea in relation to memory is what do you do afterwards? Because you must remember that it is the repetition that makes something last. Emotion is very powerful. Emotion will override, oftentimes, repetition. But the fact of the matter is, when people have a negative experience, they're likely to talk about it over and over and over and over again. When I was studying sales, it was very interesting to note that studies showed that if people went to a restaurant and they had a really, really, really good meal, they would tell three or four people about this restaurant. On the other hand, if they went to a restaurant and it was terrible, they'd tell 10.
Yeah.
Because it's the amygdala is in there really working on the negative because we don't want to do that again, right? But what I'm talking about in terms of appreciative inquiry is you continually notice what works. You continually say what works, what works, what works, and try that again. So a lot of the question then becomes, if you did some preparation, and I'm talking about doing a project, building a home, getting together with a friend, any of those things, you could look at before, during, after. Right? And look at each of those chunks, and you can see them again in this left brain way. First I did this, then I did these, and then I did this. And this is very abbreviated. This is just giving you an idea. Or you begin to see that you, as a multimodal human being, can bring in the after when you're preparing. Or while you're doing something, you can say, oh, I think maybe I want to prepare for this in a different way next time. You can mix them up. But this is the basic. 1, 2, 3, 4. Right. Comments? Questions?
Very clear.
Clear?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you say when you have a bad meal, you'll talk about it?
The studies show that people would talk about it many more times than if they had a good one. We went out last night and it was terrible. So, that's it. That's all. So word of mouth is very powerful in that way. Comments, questions, suggestions, complaints. So what I'm suggesting that it works really well in relation to memory, and you can really push this physical aspect if you realize that you are an electrochemical miracle walking around, and that electricity is going through your body at all times. You know, your brain's operating on 2.5 watts all the time. Right, constantly, and down that electricity gets sent down and into the arms, into the legs, and so forth. So, if you want to remember something, the word drops out. You scratch your left temporal lobe, because see what's happening. It's right here in your right cerebral cortex that motion is generated. Then it goes down the spine, electricity goes out the arm, back into your head, in exactly the spot where that word scissors or paperclip or clothesline or clothespin exists. It's in this matrix of cells here in the left temporal lobe.
Where's the generator?
This is a beauty, because you want to know how you can help your brain do what it does. Put your fingers in front of your ears like this. Right in front of your ears. And then move them up so that they touch. Okay? And then rock them. Can you see how I'm rocking? You are describing your movement cortex. There it is. It's right under those fingers. If you come right up from your ears, let them touch, and then rock it. And there's a different area for every part of your body. And the part for your face and your hands is really large. And the place for your back isn't very large. Right? So the parts of your body that are activating, like the hands, all the things the hands do. Slow and chop, and they do so many things, right? So there's a lot of that cortex that's devoted to the hands, right?
The brain generates the electricity. Does it generate electricity?
Yeah.
Is that the generator?
Well, you're generating throughout your body.
Throughout.
Right. So you're using ADP, the energy source, yeah. And sending and each neuron generates its own.
And there's probably a universal generator too. Is that what God is?
That's what God is. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Comments, questions.
So what does this exercise do?
This is illustrating to you, telling you, we're talking about brain geography. So everybody knows that this is my prefrontal cortex. This is what makes me polite, and this is what makes me think about the future. Right up here.
Okay.
We know in the Bible it says, without vision the people perish.
Yes.
Right? This is where vision is, right here in the front. Without the vision. And why is it that a great number of retirees die in 18 months after retiring? No vision. Nothing they're going for. But this part will bring them forward. Now the rest of the frontal lobe is involved in executive function. This part is near the back of the frontal lobe, and this is where all of your intentional movements begin, right under there.
Movements. Physical movements?
If I reach down and fit in this chair, So if I use my right hand, it came from the left side of my brain, right?
Okay.
It directs all that stuff, plus the cerebellum. I love it when you think about that. Anyway. Right in back of that, so this is movement cortex here. Right in back of that is sensory cortex. The same idea. So if something feels good on my right hand, then the sensory cortex is lighting up. It's so interesting because for over 100 years, no, for 1,000 years, the only way we've really been able to learn about the brain is through problems. In other words, you got an injury, a stroke, you know, you drank too much or used the wrong drugs or whatever it was, and some part of your brain went away. The two parts of your brain that have to do with language are on the left side. If somebody gets whacked in the head, in Wernicke's area or Broca's area, and you can't talk anymore, or you don't make sense, or you can't understand spoken language, right? Now, this is such a fantastic time, because now we have the fMRI. We can put you in the fMRI, and we can play music for you, we can show you pictures, we can show you movies, we can have somebody talk to you, and we can watch your brain respond. So we begin to see more and more and more how your brain works from a positive point of view. So now there's a whole new study of awe. Isn't that wonderful? The benefits of awe, right? And I'm working with a woman. Incidentally, this is my new interest here. This idea of neurotransmitters, and so this is a suggestion about how you can begin to influence your hormones and neurotransmitters. The woman that I'm working with her name is Loretta Bruning. B-R-U-E-N-I-N-G, and she's been studying, she has the Inner Mammal Institute, and she studies how mammals work with their own neurotransmitters and hormones. And the classic example is this saying, why zebras don't get ulcers, which is totally false, because ulcers don't have anything to do with worry. But when the lion attacks a zebra, gets its claws into the hindquarters of the zebra, but the zebra kicks and escapes, right? It doesn't go back to herd and say, oh man, that was really hurting, and boy, that lion, blah, 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 and tell everybody why. You see these scratches? That's right. No, they don't do that. They shake. And they metabolize that experience. They don't perseverate. We do. Something bad happens to us, we tell everybody. Hey, I didn't see you dance last week. What happened? Were you sick? Right? And this is why the learning a community. That's why that's they're so together. But if you know this and you say, I took a brief trip to Madagascar. Oh, you did? Wow. Yeah. All of a sudden, maybe you were sick, but you might say you took a trip to Madagascar. You don't have to tell the truth. Or you can say, I don't want to talk about that. I had a friend this morning say, my sister died, and I don't want to talk about it. Okay, well, now we know a little bit about you, and we respect that, but we also understand you don't want to talk about it. Great. You know, in this instance, you don't need to be spending time talking about how much you loved your sister and how much you're missing her. You want to be here with us now. Great. Yes?
And I think you said earlier that when different chemicals, the serotonin and dopamine versus the adrenaline and whatever, you have a different chemical response depending on which one you're thinking about. Is that right?
Yeah. My favorite example now, I'm just so excited because I finally understand why people like bingo. This has been a mystery for me, honestly, for years. I just can't get why anybody would want to do that to themselves. But I finally got it when I studied the neurotransmitters. When the person takes the ball out of the batch, you got your card there, right, with all the B-I-N-G-O, and you get a little tiny burst of serotonin, because they might pick your number. And when they do say it's B2, and you got B2, you get the shot of dopamine. So serotonin, dopamine, serotonin, dopamine, and then when you get five in a row, honey, man, rush of dopamine. Well, I want to play that again, right? And then they even give you a dollar or whatever, a Cupid doll. So you understand how addiction works and why the dopamine is such a powerful neurotransmitter, because it makes you do things over and over and over. What I'm interested in is it makes you do things over and over and over that are beneficial to you and your environment.
Can you also be addicted to the negative?
Most of us are. Yeah. Most of us are. What? Misery loves company, right? When you really start to listen to our culture, you see this crap built in. Right?
The nightly news,
right? Yes, absolutely. Misery loves company, doesn't it?
And it bleeds.
Huh?
If it bleeds, it leads.
That's right. And that's another thing, is you'll notice some people lead with their wounds. Hey, where you been? How you doing? Oh, man, right? Oh, so busy. God, it's terrible. Right? So they lead with what's wrong. And this is the cultural piece. Yes, we do. We're absolutely addicted to the negative. And I'm saying, if we honor the negative and honor the feelings that come up, this is really valuable. If you're feeling sad, be freaking sad. You know, if you got grief, dive in. Whatever it is, let it be. But you don't have to perpetuate. If you're in love, go tell everybody. Yay! Guess what? I saw a tree today. I absolutely love that tree. It was so beautiful, right? I can tell you about that tree. So here we are with this whole business of what you do after a particular event. Right? Do you tell people? Do you criticize? Do you praise? Do you analyze? There are a thousand ways for you to work with that experience that you just had. And by working with it, you're strengthening the neural pathways. And so you will remember. And so you will have now a tool that you can use the next time and the next time.
I just had an image of, you know, the carriage in front of the mule, putting a carriage in front of yourself. And there's something there, I'm not sure what it is.
Right, and we can do that for one another. We can do that for one another. And we, again, a lot of what I'm telling you, if you get it, you'll start to hear it. You'll start to hear people addicted to the negative. You'll start to hear how people use the positive, right? Somebody says, I can't remember. Of course you can remember. Right? That kind of thing. Of course you can. Questions, comments?
What is the difference between perseverate and ruminate? I've never heard the word perseverate before until you used it.
Well, I think that there is a way in which, if you looked it up in the thesaurus, they would, you know, because we can ruminate means like a cow chewing its cud, right? Mm-hmm. You bring this up and chew it again. You mm-hmm. bring this up
right.
and chew it again.
Right.
And perseverate, you know, a really good success clue is to persist.
Persevere.
Right. But if you do it and do it and do it and do it and you're not doing yourself any favors, then we call it something else. So you can drive yourself into the ground with rumination, definitely.
Okay.
No, I would say that there's definitely, but I can ruminate maybe pleasantly.
Right, right.
You say, let's go to the beach on Thursday, and I say, well, let me think about it. I'll ruminate about it. Right?
And I think it has a contemplative aspect, rumination. There's perseveration. It's like a stroke person. It's like a stroke. So you keep firing and getting nowhere.
I see.
Right,
okay.
Right. Very good. Okay. So enjoy the handout.
Thank you.
Let me know if I can speak to your Chinese checkers group or your hopscotch group or whoever you hang out with. Because I'm really totally excited about this stuff.
Yeah.
And we can change the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of Many Rivers, I have neglected to do so, but I will go immediately do so, put out our donation bowl. We will, of course, share our donations with our speaker to further his work and also retain half to maintain this space for our future events, which I ran over. We have a busy May coming up. And
the book is available.
The book is available right here on this table. You can come over and take a look. And
it's in the system.
It's even in the system, so we can sell it through the store.
We are so
on top of things. So thank you all for coming tonight, and we'll look forward to seeing you again at Manyverse. Thanks again, Chief.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
That was great.